morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund versus Citigroup. Mr. Amir Mokri, excuse me.
Thank you, Chief Judge Flom, and good morning. Cyrus Amir Mokri on behalf of the underwriter-related appellants. This is an appeal from a district court order remanding a removed action to state court.
Could you just speak up a little bit?
Certainly.
That will only record. It does not amplify. So.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Judge Flom. This is an appeal from an order remanding an action to state court. In the midst of the transfer process in the context of the multi-district litigation, the appeal basically presents two questions. One, a question of this court's appellate jurisdiction, and second, whether the multi-district litigation statute precludes the remand order that was issued below. Before I get to the question of appellate jurisdiction, I would just like to take 1 minute to briefly describe the larger multi-district litigation context of this action. In the wake of WorldCom's financial demise, as you might expect, numerous actions were filed, a lot of class actions, but perhaps for the first time, many individual actions. And many of these individual actions were commenced initially in state court. They were all removed and mostly transferred to the Southern District of New York, where the MDL panel had decided to centralize the cases. These individual actions were filed.
Pretty clear that Congress wanted these lawsuits to be in state court?
Well, Your Honor,
the Securities Act so provides, doesn't it?
Your Honor, that question actually is not before the court because it's a question of appellate jurisdiction, and allow me to address that right away. True, the remand order below was premised on a certain view of removal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. We disagree with the substance of the lower court's decision. There's no question about that. However, the question before this court on appeal isn't whether the substance of the remand order was right or wrong, but what we are arguing is that even entering a remand order under the context of this case, where
even if you're right about the merits, and even if there's appellate jurisdiction, you can't win, can you, without knocking out this multi-district litigation panel rule 1.5? It's very explicit. It says pendency of a conditional transfer order doesn't affect or suspend orders in the district court which the action is pending. Right?
Well, that Judge Posner, that certainly is what it says. The question, however,
now that's what it says and what it means. So you have, and you did say in your brief that you thought this rule was invalid. Didn't
yes.
You?
Well, to the extent that it.
What do you mean extent? It's very explicit. It's extremely explicit. You had a conditional transfer order here. And this rule says that the pendency of such an order doesn't affect orders in cases in the district court where they file.
Yes, that is certainly what it says.
It's what it means also.
It is what it means.
So it must be. So you have to show it's invalid in order to prevail.
That is correct. But under these circumstances, Your Honor.
Well, why do you think it's? I didn't get in your brief why you thought it was invalid.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that a rule that's promulgated pursuant to a statute, and in this instance, 1407, 28 U.S.C. 1407, to the extent that the rule causes judicial rulings or permits judicial rulings to completely undermine the purpose of the statute, which is also reflected on the text in the plain language of 1407b.
Well, I don't understand that. Why isn't it perfectly reasonable to have this concept of conditional transfer? Because after all, when someone like yourself, you want to transfer a case, the panel, the multi-district panel, would like to have some little interval in which the appropriateness of the transfer can be considered, and hence the conditional transfer procedure.
As a general matter, certainly. But the question is, in its particular application, such as in a case like this, consider what happened.
Well, if you're going to have a conditional transfer rule, yes, you're going to have situations in which you disagree with the ruling of the transferee court, a transferor court, or would-be transferor court. But the only way to eliminate that possibility of error would be to have no conditional transfer procedure.
No, I don't believe that. So you could have a conditional transfer procedure, Your Honor, but it could be it could be delimited in certain ways. For example, if the transferee court, as in this case, has already specifically ruled on an omnibus motion that is of general applicability to the multi-district case, if this very same issue comes up before the transferor court, and in this case there's no question that that's what happened, on the face the issues are the same. I mean, even if you take a step back, the complaints are copycat complaints, and to construe the conditional transfer order rule 1.5 literally,
it's not a matter of construction. I don't see any way around the rule.
Well, if you call it construction or application, one way or the other.
No, I don't understand that. If the rule is valid, you're finished.
No, but
because the rule is perfectly clear. What you're really saying is, well, the rule shouldn't be applied when the transferor court makes a dumb decision.
Well,
that wipes out the rule.
Yes, I mean, it's, you know, and that perhaps raises the question. I mean, it, does the rule need to be stricken entirely? No, perhaps there is a way to interpret the rule.
Well, how would you frame the desired exception?
Well, the exception would be when a multi-district transferee court, as in this case, has ruled on a specific issue that's of general applicability, then a transferor court can't, contravene that ruling in the way, for example, that happened in this case.
What is the basis of that kind of distinction? I don't understand how you make this distinction.
Well, if you, Judge Cudahy, if you consider the purposes of the multi-district litigation statute, it is, after all, and this is not the subject of dispute, it's one of the statutes, the purpose of which is pretty clear, that is to avoid inefficiencies and duplicative efforts, and very importantly, inconsistent rulings in like cases. Suppose you have the transferee court.
Well, in this case, ultimately to overrule the Securities Act, I guess. That's what you're aiming for in the end.
No, that's, just to that point, even though, again, that's not an issue before this court as to what the Securities Act does with respect to removal, the Second Circuit has ruled.
Well, that's the ultimate consequence of the argument that you're making, though, in this case, isn't it?
Except that there is a very important procedural issue concerning multi-district litigation. This is a case not just about this particular litigation, but it's a question about what's going to happen in the future. Are you going to have a situation in which an MDL transferee court issues a ruling, and then are you going to allow the transferor courts to undermine that? That's a recipe for having multi-district litigation unglued at
the
outset.
Well, this conditional transfer period, it's just a few days, isn't it?
No, not necessarily. It can take months.
But in this case, how long did it take?
In this case, I don't know the exact answer, but it was not a few days. The few days that's reflected in the record is that the conditional transfer order was issued a couple of days before the district court ruled. I believe the conditional transfer order was issued September 6th, and the ruling came down September 9th.
When did the transfer order take effect? Cease to be conditional?
The record reflects that the transfer order was withdrawn once the remand order had been issued. But in this case, if memory serves me right, the application to the MDL panel for a conditional transfer order was made at the same time that we removed the case, at or about the same time, and our practice was to move for a stay of the litigation at the same time. We did that in all of these different jurisdictions. So that would have happened a few months before. So just to go to the conditional transfer process, it takes a while. It's not an instantaneous thing.
So the limitation would be that once subject matter jurisdiction has already been ruled upon, the transferor court should be barred from any consideration.
Well, I wouldn't state it that broadly.
Wouldn't we need to come up with a
no? Chief Judge Flom, I think you can articulate it in a different way that would cover subject matter jurisdiction, but also certain other pretrial, pre-transfer motions. For instance, you can say just define it in the terms of what the transferee court considers and what the transferee court does. And if there is a motion pending before the transferee court, or if the transferee court has indicated an intent to, on the record, an intent to hear a certain motion, then transferor courts should be barred from ruling on that. The reason why I would submit that a subject matter jurisdiction rule would be a little broad is that subject matter jurisdiction is a horse of many different hues. You'll have diversity cases where the case is really individualized and the, so in those instances it may not make sense. But certainly in a case where there's a pure question of law that's being decided by the transferee court, as in this case, where it's of uniform application, it makes perfect sense to have an exception that would work in the way that we propose.
Well, I can appreciate the potential efficiency and consistency, but I'm just trying to frame up how narrow and specific this could be.
There
would be a workable rule, not just applied to, this particular case.
Well, certainly. And I think... I think the narrowness will derive from what I think is the purpose of the statute and also the language of 1407B, which is that the cases shall be before the transferee court. That is, whatever the transferee court's conduct of the litigation should really govern, and that should be the parameter. I see my guess. If I can, yes, thank you very much.
Surely. Thank you. Mr. Isaacson?
May it please the Court, I'm Eric Isaacson, counsel for the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. I'm accompanied today by Benny Goodman, my colleague, and by the general counsel for the fund, Kathy O'Brien. Counsel has argued today that Rule 1.5 is void and that Section 1407 revokes the district court's power to decide issues that Rule 1.5 indicates are clearly within its jurisdiction and power to decide. Striking aspect of this case is that those points were never raised below. They did not argue any of this below. They haven't argued this in any district court, to the best of my knowledge, and they say they've had quite a few cases in which they had the opportunity. There are six remand orders of cases similar to this one. To the extent that they've been appealed, the appeals have been dismissed, the Sixth Circuit case being on all fours with this one. Only time that they've raised this argument has been on appeal, not in the district court. One reason is because it's something that is not apparent. It's not a clear error for certain. You don't look at the statute, it's Section 1407, and come to the conclusion that the district court lacked power or that Rule 1.5 is void. But there's another preliminary point that's worth making.
His argument is it lacks power by virtue of his interpretation of this or invalidation of the multi-district rule.
He argues that basically
if he's correct, that dissolves the issue of appellate jurisdiction.
Well, he goes to Section 1407, the multi-district statute, and says that under Section 1407, because the intent is that there be coordinated proceedings, that the multi-district rule is void, that it's overridden by statute, as I understand it. Those are points he didn't make below. He told the district court that it had discretion to decide the issue. Discretion to decide the issue, whether to stay or whether to remand. To say the district court has discretion is to say it has power. They didn't argue that it lacked power. They told it did have power and discretion to decide the questions presented.
Well, you're now arguing, I guess, that it lacks power in the same sense that if the judge was properly recused, he would lack power. Is that right?
Well, they try to fit it within that. But a judge who's been properly recused can't hear the case at all. Section 1407 doesn't say that a judge has to recuse himself as soon as it looks like a case might be subject to a conditional transfer order. This court in General Electric versus Byrne made it very clear that the fact there's a conditional transfer order does not revoke power of the judge before whom the case is still pending. And that was a case where there were four cases of five, four of them subject to conditional transfer orders. And this court said that the transfer or court retained jurisdiction. The transferee court didn't have it. The transfer or court had the power over the case, not the transferee court. Now, when they were arguing the remand issue, arguing against remand before the district court in this case, they cited the analysis of a district court case called Myers versus Bayer, which has been widely followed. They told the district judge in this case...
Oh, forget about all that. Look,
okay.
What is... your opponent has pointed to a real problem, which is pretty absurd to have the same case being litigated in state courts and in New York and goodness knows where else. So what is there anything in the law that would deal with this problem, or is it just a defect in the multi-district panel's rule?
I don't think there's a defect in the multi-district panel's rule, and I don't think it's a problem. If it had been something that created a serious problem, you'd have seen the issue before today. I don't think you've got a serious problem here. Now, most of the concern reflected in the multi-district litigation statute is going to be over inconsistent discovery orders, issues where a district judge has discretion. There's a range of choices for what you might decide to do or not do, not questions of law where there's a right answer and a wrong answer. Now, if a district judge who's going to be transferring a case renders a decision that's at odds with the transferee judge's view of the law or the facts or what ought to be done, and the case gets transferred, the transferor judge's order probably is not going to control. It's not going to be law of the case. The transferee judge is going to say, no, these are my rulings on discovery. This is my view of the substantive law that governs this case.
I don't understand you. What does that have to do with this case?
Well,
this case is going to be proceeding, if you prevail, this case will be proceeding in a state court for discovery and everything else, won't it?
Only because the issue presented is one that relates to the question of federal jurisdiction.
That's not responsive.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
There's going to be a lot of duplication and potential inconsistency, and my question was, is that just the way it is, or are there some other resources, procedurally, statutory, for avoiding this duplication and inconsistency?
That's just the way it is when the question is one of jurisdiction
of
the federal court.
Okay, so your answer is no, nothing can be done about it.
Well, you can coordinate the discovery in the cases we've been doing.
Who's the you?
Pardon?
Who's the you can coordinate discovery?
Oh, it's a general you. The litigants can coordinate discovery.
Oh, if they cooperate with each other.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, is there
and we're trying to do that.
Is there a history of state court judges, for example, deferring on discovery when we have what you suggest has probably occurred before?
Yeah, typically judges don't want to make things overly difficult. I mean, we've got some different issues in this case than in the cases that are pending before Judge Cote. We're going to be taking discovery with respect to bond issues that are not being litigated before Judge Cote. There are a number of ways in which the case is different, so the discovery will be a little bit broader.
Well, where there's overlapping focus, is there an agreement on discovery, for example?
Where there's overlapping focus, we have been coordinating the efforts because we don't want duplication any more than the defendants do. It's not like we want to be doing the same thing over and over and over again. Well, for a number of reasons, you know, reflected in the Securities Act itself, Congress's policy was that you ought to be able to sue in your home state court. Congress understood.
My question is, why do you want to be in state court?
Why do we want to be in state court? The Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund feels far more comfortable litigating this case in an Illinois court than in New York City, on Wall Street, Your Honor. And that's why Section 22A provides what it does.
Greater sophistication in that area in the Illinois
Madison
County. Well, Your Honor, the question is whether, you know, prospectus and registration statements were misleading or omitted material information. Those are issues that, quite frankly, common law judges are very familiar with and very competent
Illinois
to handle.
Not too many Illinois employees living in New York. That's
You have some broader and superior discovery rules as well, and we've got some different claims than what's before Judge Coe. Another reason not to want to be in New York litigating this case is that the Section 10B claims are dominating the class action litigation and are the focus of the lawyers there and the focus of the proceedings there, rather than Section 11 claims, the strict liability claims, which have far superior provisions with respect to remedies, far more lenient standards of proof, but we ought to be able to litigate our case that's focused on the issues that matter for this case rather than being subsumed in the New York litigation, where, quite frankly, the tag-along cases are subject to draconian discovery, limitations on discovery. We've got more flexibility here. We can better serve our client here, and the client is far more comfortable litigating the case here. And Congress in Section 22A said that's the way it ought to be. And when Congress amended the statute in 1998 with the Securities Litigation Uniform Standards Act of 1998, it added a narrow exception for certain class actions that does not cover this case. Congress preserved the rule that the Illinois Retirement Fund, Municipal Retirement Fund, ought to be able to litigate right here in Illinois in state court. That's how Congress wants it. And if there's a complication, it's a complication that was intended by Congress. If there's a defect, it's a defect that was mandated by Congress. That's who they ought to be going to. They shouldn't be coming to you making arguments they never presented below. After they told the court that it had discretion to stay or remand. I mean, one of the questions here is, can you tell the district court it has power to decide an issue, and when it decides the issue against you, appeal on the ground that it was wrong to believe you? That's what they're doing.
Suppose the Mullet District transfer order were farther along and this Rule 1.5 didn't apply. What would be the situation then?
If the transfer order were further along, so the case had already been transferred to New York?
Well, I don't know. How long is it conditional until the transfer actually takes place?
It's a conditional order for a specified period of time unless a motion to stay it is filed because it's going to be opposed. And, you know, we would have filed that
motion. What happens when it becomes unconditional then?
It becomes unconditional at some point if it's not contested, or if there's a ruling that says, no, the objections to it are overruled, it goes to New York. And if the case had been transferred to New York, we wouldn't be here because this court wouldn't have jurisdiction over Judge Coe.
What if they remove it again after the transfer order becomes final?
The transfer order is not going to become final. It's void. It's been withdrawn. There's no transfer order in this case on account of the fact that the case was dismissed.
No, I mean the conditional.
Remanded.
The conditional transfer order issued in New York, that became final at some point, didn't it?
Well, a conditional transfer order is issued in each of the tag-along cases. It becomes final in the cases where the judges have not remanded the case to state court for want of federal jurisdiction. In this case, it never became final. There is no final conditional transfer order as to this case. The conditional transfer order never took effect.
Oh, you mean it's the transfer court that issues such an order, not the
The multi-district panel.
The multi-district panel issues the order.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's just like in General Electric versus Byrne.
But it issued an order, didn't it? I mean, that conditional transfer, or didn't it become final at some point?
No, Your Honor. It issued an order that says this could become an order if no objection to it is filed and the case is remaining pending. There's no transfer order with respect to this case anywhere right now. That transfer order never took effect. They don't contend it took effect.
Well, what happened with the other cases that were transferred to New York?
In the other cases that were transferred to New York, the judges, you know, following the analysis of Meyer versus Bayer, and of
how does this work? So someone files a case in a district court in California, say. Now, then someone goes to the multi-district panel and asks for a transfer order? Is that how it works?
Yes, Your Honor.
Party to that lawsuit would ask for transfer?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it issues a conditional order first?
It issues a conditional
for
order.
For how long?
It takes several weeks.
So, I see. So if, well, could they remove the case again if it goes back to state court and ask the multi-district panel for another transfer order?
The question would be, can you remove again after you've already lost a series of multiple removals?
Yes.
Without a change in circumstances, I don't think they could do that consistent with, you know, their obligations of members
what?
Of the bar.
With what? Consistent with what? Why couldn't they remove, and 5 minutes after removing, they run to the multi-district panel, and they get a transfer order? Is there some statute that would forbid that?
The panel would issue a conditional transfer order, and we'd take that conditional transfer order, and we would take
would
Judge Murphy's opinion.
Would they have to issue a conditional transfer order? Couldn't they make it unconditional?
I don't think that's their practice, Your Honor.
It may not be their practice, but then, you know, your opponent could say, look, this is ridiculous, this case is in the wrong place, and we want you to issue an unconditional order and get it to New York. Is there anything to prevent that?
Your Honor, I am not certain as to what the limitations of the multi-district panel's powers are in that kind of a context. I can't give you a certain answer as to that. I know that the multi-district panel understands what's going on in this case. It knows that there are remand orders going to jurisdiction in these cases. In the case that was going up on appeal, where the appeal was dismissed in the Sixth Circuit, I believe there was a letter from the multi-district litigation panel when the district judge, Judge Haynes, inquired, what should I do? The multi-district panel said, you can go ahead and decide it if you want to, or you can, you know, transfer it to the, you know, let the conditional transfer order become final, and it'll be transferred to the transferee judge. There's in Asbestos Products, in a published opinion, the multi-district panel and bank says that the conditional transfer orders give enough time for, quote, those courts wishing to address such motions to have adequate time to decide them if they wish to, and that also allows them to be addressed by the transferee judge if they choose not to rule on them. It's a matter of discretion with the district judge, Your Honor, according to the multi-district panel. According to the Sixth Circuit in Bank Ohio, it's something that the district judge ought to rule on because federal jurisdiction is a preliminary consideration to jurisdiction to transfer. I see that my time has run.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Amir Mokri, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just begin by addressing the transfer issue. As I'm reminded, one of the things that occurs is that a party asking for a conditional first asks for a transfer, a conditional transfer order is issued. However, the other party can oppose the conditional transfer order, and briefing ensues, and then the multi-district panel has to decide whether the case goes or stays. And in fact, In the literally scores of individual actions that have been filed in this case, IMRF's counsel has served as national counsel, in every single instance, an objection was lodged to the transfer of the action to the Southern District of New York, and so that has accounted for a lot of the delays that have.
Well, of course, they have a substantial argument against transfer.
Well. In fact, the multi-district litigation panel has ruled on that, and in their rulings, they always indicate that the transferee court is in an appropriate position to decide the pretrial jurisdictional issues. So that, in effect, is the view of the MDL panel itself. On the issue of...
of course, not a discovery issue. The question whether these cases are removable despite that Securities Act provision, that's not a discovery issue. And it's not obvious that a district court in New York should have the monopoly of adjudication of the issue.
Yeah, well, I would respectfully take issue with that, Your Honor. I think that in the multi-district litigation context, when you do have a question that is common to the multi-district litigation, under the statutory scheme, it only makes sense for the transferee court to decide it. And this, this principle, I think, has been recognized in many of the decisions.
Well, there advantage diversity as well as decentralization. You can get the opinions of several judges. That might help to come up with a sensible solution rather than having a single judge decide.
Well, except that in the multi-district context, that wouldn't happen because you are talking about one overall litigation.
It is happening. On whether this removal is possible in these cases.
It is happening, but to the detriment of the conduct of the litigation. I think the philosophy of
It's making it more expensive.
Well, it's making it more expensive, but also I think that the legal system generally doesn't tolerate or doesn't like to tolerate inconsistent decisions within the same overall case. Now, the same diversity could be achieved over time, and that's how it happens ordinarily in the course of different lawsuits in different years. And that is not unusual at all. But the interests of the multi-district litigation compel the conclusion that we are seeking. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will